Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. quince.com/style.
Truth and Movies. On this 60th episode, Josh Brolin and Benicio del Toro are back for another action-packed trip south of the border in Sicario 2 Soldado.
You want to see this thing through? I'm going to have to get dirty.
Then, we welcome the return of director Deborah Granick with her survivalist father-daughter drama, Leave No Trace.
I wasn't where I was supposed to be, so they took me away.
And, in Film Club, we look back at Deborah Granick's previous film, Winter's Bone, the independent drama that gave Jennifer Lawrence her first big break.
Do you have any brothers or sisters that might be able to help?
I got a little brother and a little sister, 12 and 6.
Well, who's taking care of them right now?
I am.
All coming up in Truth and Movies, a Little White Lies podcast. It's Michael Leder here in the host seat again, sitting across from Little White Lies' Adam Woodward.
Hi.
And Manuela Lazic. Welcome back, Manuela.
Hello.
How are you all doing today?
Very well on this very sunny day.
In a nice air-conditioned room.
Yeah.
So we have a bit of correspondence from the previous couple of episodes about Hereditary. This is Ben from Devon saying, great discussion about Hereditary on your latest podcast. Having watched it and enjoyed it greatly, I was struck by the amount of comparisons I felt between the film and the last third of Ben Wheatley's 2011 masterpiece Kill List. Without wanting to give any spoilers, there were several set pieces and important plot points that both films shared. Did anyone else notice this? Now, am I right in thinking I'm the only one that's seen both these films?
I really want to see Hereditary in a cinema.
Yeah.
I've just been watching too much football. And haven't carved out a few hours in my week yet. But it's on my to-watch list. I will go and see it. But yeah, Kill List is really great.
Kill List really is terrific. And I think what Ben is getting at here is this mixture of family drama, the family breaking down, and this mysterious thread through the film about a cult that may or may not be affecting the family. And both Hereditary and Kill List really go is there it, in its final third.
Is it as ambiguous as Kill List? I've heard it's not.
Hereditary. I think Hereditary falls down in a less ambiguous way. Right. Yeah,
I haven't seen Hereditary. I'm very scared.
Is that Kill List?
No, neither, actually. I'm very bad with, not with horror movies, but with, you know, shock horror movies. Like, I'm always really excited to see them. And then when I'm sitting down, just before the movie starts, I realize I'm about to see something very scary. And I'm like, why am I doing this? Mm-hmm. But then I have a good time sometimes. When I saw The Witch at TIFF, that's exactly what happened a few years ago. I was stuck between a lot of people. And during the film, I was freaking out. And they were probably thinking, why is she here? But I had a great time.
Yeah.
So maybe I will see it.
And Kill List might be a good film club pick in the future.
Definitely.
One definitely to watch in the best audio surroundings possible, because the sound design, kind of like with Hereditary, the sound design creates such a tense atmosphere throughout. So much in there. Anyway, thank you, Ben. If you want to send any more comments to us, you can send us an email at truthandmovies@tcolondon.com or on Twitter at LWLies, or there's a comment section at lwlies.com/podcast. So shall we get cracking with the reviews this week? First up today, Sicario 2 Soldado. Here's a clip from the trailer.
How would you define terrorism? The current definition is any individual or group that uses violence to achieve a political goal. The administration believes that the drug cartels fit that definition.
I
see this thing through, I'm going to have to get dirty.
Josh Brolin there. He's back with Benicio del Toro in tow for the sequel to Denis Villeneuve's 2015 thriller. This time the war against the Mexican cartels is escalating when it's revealed that they may be trafficking terrorists across the border. Now, Adam, you have written the review for Little White Lies.
Yes.
We have a quote here, a grimly macho action movie. Did we need a sequel to Sicario, do you think?
Well, I think it's interesting that this is the second part, effectively, of a proposed Sicario trilogy. And watching the first film, which I think we saw in Cannes in 2015, would not have expected there to be two other Sicario films. But it does sort of make sense in that, effectively, they've just done the same thing again. It's clearly got a bit of a bigger budget, so you have a few more like helicopter shots and a few more explosions. Effectively, Benicio del Toro's character replaces Emily Blunt from the first film as the sort of film's emotional centre.
Yeah.
But yeah, for me, it was like much the same experience as the first film. Mm-hmm. Started off really well, kind of tapers out towards the end and just left me feeling, put me in a weird mood, actually. It just, I felt like it was very, very sort of self-serious and cynical and not quite what I needed from, you know, a cinema-going experience.
Yeah, you talk about it having seeming to have a larger budget, but it's hard not to see this almost as a bargain basement sequel when you don't have the same director, you don't have the same star, the same cinematographer, Roger Deakins, who shot the last one, of course, being one of the most feted cinematographers of his generation, composer Johan Johansson, another person that was singled out in reviews for a very well-reviewed film, Sicario 2015. You don't have them returning, you don't have Emily Blunt as the emotional core. It's hard not to see this as a, you know, the B-team in a way.
Yeah, just a note on the score, actually, I really found it quite overbearing, the compositions here. It's just full of those generic horn blasts that you associate with like Hans Zimmer, and
which is a shame because Johan Johansson passed away tragically in February this year, and it's Hildur Gudnadóttir, his sort of co-composer, Icelandic cellist, who takes over here, and it doesn't really find an identity in the way that the score did in the last one. Manuela, what's your relationship with the Sicario franchise, and how did the sequel pan out for you?
I mean, it's hard to say if it's worse or if it's just as bad, but so I watched the first one the night before seeing the new one, and I was completely appalled. I can't believe this is a movie that people take seriously. I think it's absolute trash and it's vile. And the new one is kind of worse in that it's trying to have its cake and eat it too a lot more, because the first one was more about Americans, you know, doing bad things but saying, well, this is how it is, it's the war, so we don't have a choice. Whereas this one is more Americans doing things and saying this is how it is, but also at some point realizing that they're wrong, but then doing it anyway. And so they're just like, they're trying to be the heroes at the same time as they are the villains. And it's so disingenuous. It's so petty. And then they will be saying, well, this is what Americans do, you know? Mm-hmm. Like, yeah, but I don't need a movie about this. And the worst thing is that at some point near the beginning, I was actually crying because I was so upset because...
Right, in the second film.
In the second film, because there's a... Basically, the film makes a direct connection between immigration at the Mexican border and terrorists. Mm-hmm. And I was just like, this is the absolute last thing I need to see in a movie. And it's so, so dishonest, and it's so vile. It's absolutely insane.
It's interesting, both Sicario 1 and this one, that they're not interested in being pious films at all. They're ripping from the headlines from the political situation right now and spinning it into what is sort of airport thriller sort of material. What made the first film stand out was that it had this veneer of classic filmmaking, Denis Villeneuve, who's such a craftsman, and all these other craftsmen behind the scenes. And this film, once you take some of that away, this is much more of an exploitation movie.
Yeah, but it's interesting because I think, in a way, the first one, in the opposite way, it was worse for me because of that veneer. Because that veneer made it pass as good. And everybody was like, well, yeah, it's not great politically, but, oh, it's beautiful. And I hate when people do that. It's like, no, a movie's a whole thing. You can't take one thing and like not think about the politics. Whereas this one, in a way, it's more honest because it's more bluntly cruel and silly.
But this is part of the world, the sort of narrative fictional world that the screenwriter Taylor Sheridan is creating with his films. He wrote the first Sicario that brought him to attention. He's made since films like Wind River, Hell or High Water, these sort of semi-Western, neo-Western heist movies, thrillers that are very interested in very macho archetypes in modern day political situations. Adam, these themes, do they trouble you about this film, or is it enjoyable as an action thriller?
I think from a craft point of view, there's certainly you know, some good set pieces, and there's some good cinematography, and there's some stuff to enjoy.
Yeah.
I think Manuela makes a good point on the politics and how the film like conflates, quite pointedly conflates, these ideas of like human trafficking and immigration and also American foreign policy and national security and all these things. It doesn't really make a comment on that stuff for me, or at least not a strong enough one. Yeah, it just kind of uses
it for suspense and for plot twists in a way that's so disingenuous. But at the same time, what I was thinking watching it is, this is insane. An American Secretary of State would never order such an insane thing. But then I was like, well, the president did put children in cages last week, so who knows? Mm-hmm. And I think it's very interesting to look at films where there's a real, where there's an American president in now because of the situation. It makes everything so, takes at the same time so much meaning, but at the same time it's completely pointless because we have no idea what he's doing. Mm-hmm. And it's very upsetting to watch, I think.
Okay. It's interesting for me. It reminds me of films I would have watched growing up, maybe late night on ITV with my granddad. You know, these masculine films, sort of written maybe from a Tom Clancy novel, where it's Clint Eastwood or Harrison Ford taking on the IRA or taking on anonymous terrorists from the Middle East. And it seems so out of step with this more, I don't want to talk about snowflake culture or anything like that, but we are much more aware of what film can do and what film maybe should do or how it should deal and its responsibility to towards the headlines.
Yeah. That's kind of one of the points I make in my review, is that it doesn't feel like it has a sense of purpose or a message. And yeah, in this sort of like, I mean, 2015, this is like pre-Trump, right? Mm-hmm. So at a time of, you know, fractious US-Mexico relations and you know, the way all of this, the themes in this film are dealt with in like the media, you just think it needs to be a bit more tuned into that and a bit more sensitive and actually maybe a bit more progressive and positive in its politics. Mm-hmm. I didn't want something necessarily naive or overly optimistic, but just something that didn't feel so, as I say, grimly macho and very sort of gloomy.
Yeah.
It reminded me, I don't know if you've seen the Ken Burns Vietnam War documentary series.
No.
Some really good stuff in that about how essentially Robert McNamara, who's like the Secretary of State at the time, knew basically that they couldn't win the war from like very early on, and they kind of carried on with it and dug themselves into this very deep hole. And, you know, all this stuff obviously came out later on. So I think the representation of people in men in very powerful positions in the US government making these decisions, there is a sort of like kernel of truth to that.
Definitely.
But the way it sort of parcels that out and the way, as you say, uses it as a quite a kind of cheap plot mechanic without really commenting or even actually sort of condemning these people.
It's again, I think a thing that Taylor Sheridan does a lot is fake ambiguity. He's just kind of presenting both sides, and at the end you're just like, I don't know, it's bad, but circumstances. And it's so petty. Like, if you're a filmmaker, you better have a point of view, you know? Otherwise, what are we watching? I can watch the news and not know what to think, but if you make a movie, have a point of view and have the courage of your point of view, and don't pretend to be ambiguous when you just want to please both sides. I just found that so pointless.
There is one really good scene, I think, in the movie, which is bit later on, where Benicio del Toro's character is essentially on the run, and he's in the Mexican desert, and he comes across this farmer, this like peasant guy, and he starts communicating with him using sign language, and we learn a bit more about Benicio del Toro's character's backstory. And it's just like a really beautiful scene about human connection, and it feels like at that point the film's reaching for, you know, a statement or a message or something. I don't, you're looking at me, Manuela, like you thought that was the worst scene in the film. But
I think not the worst, because there are a lot of bad ones, but I found it so forced, and it's like, oh well, hitmen have feelings too.
Well, it's an interesting part, isn't it, where the first film had this quite interesting structure where the first half of Sicario, you're Emily Blunt and you're being introduced to this crack team who present themselves as being advisors to the Department of Justice, but really they're a death squad pretty much that are meant to shake things up in Mexico. And in the second half, the perspective shifts onto Benicio del Toro's character, who is turns out to be the Sicario of the title, the hitman. And for this film, when you don't have the emotional centre, you have to shift perspective onto Josh Brolin and Benicio del Toro's characters. And I think that one of the problems with the film is it doesn't really know what to do, how to make either of them into protagonists, how to make them into co-protagonists or whatever.
Yeah.
But that's not necessarily the fault of the actors behind the characters. I think Benicio del Toro is one of the greatest of his generation still. Mm. He can do so much with so little. And I know you have you interviewed him over the weekend, Adam, didn't you, Benicio?
Yeah, I spoke to him actually specifically about his quite distinctive mode of performance. And he seems to eschew that. I think he gives muscular performances, but in a very unshowy way where he's not so much posturing. And I mean, Josh Brolin in this, and I like Josh Brolin to an extent, but so much of what he does relies on this like framework that's built around him. Oh, so he can kind of do his big blustery.
Mm-hmm. His arms in this movie are insane.
Yeah, and there's lots of shots where he's wrapping his arm in gauze and kind of flexing. Yeah. And Del Toro doesn't do any of that, and he doesn't really need to. He carries so much more weight with simple gestures. And
his face.
Just his face, yeah.
And his
actually,
face is so weird.
I think the reason I really enjoy that sign language scene is because he communicates, obviously, literally with the sign language, but he communicates so much more about his character and actually a little bit about the story. And yeah, he is, like you say, one of the great actors of his generation and just a really commanding, reliable presence.
So we have a clip from the interview. Should we listen to that now?
Yeah, let's.
Well, you know, I just go on the character. You know, sometimes, you know, I don't know. It's not always that I'm always kind of cutting lines in order to show something. It's just that sometimes in a script you read it and there is a character saying something and there's a description of what he's saying or what he's doing. And sometimes the writer is writing it for the reader. And the reader is not watching it, is not seeing it, is just reading it. Might be seeing it in his imagination, but is not actually seeing it. So when you're actually doing it, you realize, why would I be saying I'm holding a microphone right now when you're actually doing it, you know? So that's kind of like, that's what happens a lot of the time. I also think that someone said that if you really want to know someone, watch their gestures and don't necessarily listen to their words, because words can lie, whatever that means. But for me, what it means is like sometimes a gesture will speak volumes, and sometimes a gesture would do that much better than a great writer could. You know, I think that you see it, you know, in life, and some of us are more aware of it than others. And when you're in the business of human behavior, you might be more aware of it than people who are not, you know.
Benicio del Toro there. I listened to an interview with Josh Brolin just this morning, and I love that he calls Benicio Benny. Mm. So I was thinking about this as the Benny and Josh movie.
Yeah.
So, as you said, Adam, this is a setup for a potential trilogy.
Yeah.
On the basis of this, are we excited for Sicar 3-0? Or?
I just guess they'll do the same thing, so maybe no. I can't see how they can really progress the story in an interesting way. And Benicio del Toro is surely signed up for the next one already. Mm-hmm. It's good to see him just doing his thing. He's sort of fairly self-deprecating, I think, in that interview clip. Yeah. But he really is such a perceptive actor and, as I say, can communicate so much with doing so little, really. So I will always, always watch what he's in. And actually watching this did kind of make me think I must go and dig out my copy of Shay later when I get in.
Oh, yeah.
I will return for him and probably no one else.
Well, watching him in this, for me, made me wish that he'd do what Liam Neeson, Sean Penn, etc. have done and do a sort of Taken franchise. I'd love to see... Benicio del Toro is Alejandro Sicario, revenge thriller. I'd love to see that. Manuela, are you excited about what's to come for the franchise, or are you out now?
I mean... I'm actually curious because the second movie ends on a sort of cliffhanger. I mean, not going to give anything away, but I think it could be interesting. Mm-hmm. I don't want to have a bad time at the movies like that. I don't know. I don't like it. It's
so
not great.
What scores would you give this one, Manuela?
Two. That's generous, but I will give it two because, well, Benicio is good. It's a bit more morally aware and ambiguous than the first one, but it's not saying much. And yeah, at the end, there's the original theme from the first movie that is really good, and it returns, so it's nice. Mm-hmm. That's it.
Adam?
I think I'd go 3 for anticipation, 3 for enjoyment, mostly for Del Toro, and probably 2 for in retrospect.
Yeah.
Sorry, I meant 2 all the way.
Oh, 2 all the way. Triple 2. I think I'd say I enjoyed the last one on a craft level, so in anticipation 3, but enjoyment 2 in retrospect 2, I think. One thing I would say that I did enjoy, I love that now we've gone down the list of female actors who could play thankless government roles. We've come to Catherine Keener, who's more seen in sort of indie comedy dramas, you know, walking and talking down a corridor.
I don't know if she's well cast because she's so alive and she's supposed to play someone who's kind of, you know, just
very
doing her job.
Dour and very...
Yeah, she's great to look at, to see act, but I don't know if she matches the role.
Well, I hope the paycheck was good.
Yeah.
So, Sicario 2, Soldado, that's out this week. I don't think it's a strong recommendation from the table today. Up next, though, Leave No Trace. So Leave No Trace, Ben Foster and Thomasin McKenzie are a father and daughter making a life for themselves in the middle of the forest on the outskirts of Portland, Oregon. That is, until they're discovered by the authorities and society comes calling. Here's a clip of young Tom in conversation with a group of girls at a care home.
So what are you doing here?
I wasn't where I was supposed to be, so they took me away. Well, they don't think I was where I was supposed to be.
Okay, where were you?
With my dad. In the park.
So you were homeless then?
No.
Why else would you be living in the woods? Okay, if you had a home, they wouldn't have brought you here.
Well, they just don't understand that it was my home. Where's your dad now? I think he's somewhere in this building. He's gonna come get me.
Tiff, do you know anyone whose parents come back for them?
No.
Me neither.
There was Thomasin McKenzie there, giving a great young performance, I thought, in Deborah Granik's Leave No Trace. Manuela, so were you a fan of Deborah Granik's work beforehand, Winter's Bone, and then into this one, or was this a fresh experience for you?
This was a fresh experience for me. I watched Winter's Bone for Film Club, so I hadn't seen it before. But I quite enjoyed this one, Leave No Trace. I wasn't a huge fan, like a lot of people have been. But it is a really good movie, and what I love particularly about it, and about Deborah Granik's work, which I realize now, is that she really brings out perspectives that we never really see. The kind of people that are not in movies, that are not the heroes of movies. And also she doesn't judge them. She doesn't judge either them or the people against them, because often it's outcasts. She loves outcasts. And she gives them a lot of space to just be themselves and just live the life they want to live, and also confront society, but or the people around them. But she really never really judges either side, which is really hard to do, I think. And it's not a lack of point of view at all. It's more she's quite observant and she understands that life is complicated and people do things for certain reasons. And in this movie, in Leave No Trace, it's a very delicate subject because. So this family, this father and his daughter living in the woods, and we don't really get why until quite into the movie. I don't want to spoil it, but it's a, you know, understandable, at the same time, not understandable reason, because it's a very specific experience. And it's not the kind of experience that people think about in real life. And it's not the kind of people that people care about. And that's the whole reason why they're in the woods, because no one cares about them. Mm-hmm. No one is there to look after them. So they have to do it themselves. But then society comes calling because society can't stand people, you know, doing it their own way and not harming anyone, apparently. So it's, yeah, I think I found it quite powerful. I think it could have been a bit shorter and a bit more pointed and less slow. But it is good. The young girl is pretty good. I watched Winter's Bone and I think Jennifer Lawrence was astonishing. And this girl is not Jennifer Lawrence, but she's not bad.
Well, we'll talk about Jennifer Lawrence shortly. Yeah. What I love about Deborah Granik's films is that she is so they're so delicately balanced perspective-wise. Mm. She's so curious about humanity and then humanity within these social structures. So Winter's Bone is in sort of meth country. And this one, I expected something to be, this to be just as miserable and grim as Winter's Bone. But actually, no, it's a much more sweet and soulful and sad and melancholic film. But its central questions are much more, I don't want to say the word universal, but they're much more human on the level of father-daughter parental relationships, finding your place in the world, finding your place in relation to the, do you want to say, nanny state or the big society. Can someone live today with an independent mind and independent means? These are big questions, but it's also quite a small movie. Adam, did you respond to this? I think this has been quite well received in Little White Lies in general.
Yeah, absolutely. David of this parish is a big, big fan. I think he's given it 5 stars, and I think it's probably going to be one of his top films of the year. And I maybe didn't quite like it quite as much as him, but I mean, it's just a hugely compassionate movie. And like you say, Manuel, it's not really critical of society or the systems that are in place. And actually, it shows that, you know, there are often support networks and kind of parachutes for people in these situations, but it's not always a quick fix, and you know there are people who genuinely do care out there. But it's an interesting struggle, I think, that they that she portrays here between the regulations and the systems and everything that is in place for people to live comfortably and securely, and then you know these issues which, specific to this character, quite hard to relate to actually if you've not experienced it yourself. But I think that's more power to Deborah Granik for the way she humanizes the character and makes you really care about, you know, the particular journey of him and his daughter.
Yeah, and it's an interesting comparison point with Sicario too. This is an equally apolitical film, but one that really does benefit from the aura of politics. There are no bad guys in this film. There's no finger pointing in either direction politically, but there is this sense of America that's falling away.
Yeah, I think Sicario, it's more that everybody's a bad guy. So it's like, oh, well, you know, everything's bad. Whereas here, it's like, no one is really a bad guy. Everybody's just doing their best. And I think that's why, like, another thing I really like about the film is how it uses the father-daughter relationship to communicate on that idea of, you know, fitting into society or not. Because the little girl doesn't have her father's experience. You know, she's been with her father all her life, obviously. So she only knows that perspective. But once she discovers another one, she has to make that choice of whether or not, you know, she wants to stay with her father or, you know, find out what she wants to do. And that kind of functions as a great microcosm or metaphor for that thing of, you know, do I want to fit in society or do I want to be my own person? And it's also about, you know, father and daughter. That's a link that everybody can relate to, most people. You know, do I want to be my family's continuation, or am I my own person? And I think in that movie it's shown in a very unique way. It's not at all, you know, didactic. It's very, very weird, and it goes one way and then the other way, and it doesn't demonize anyone.
It reminded me a little bit of two films in particular from the last couple of years, one being Room and the other being Captain Fantastic, both films which are about parents bringing up their children in very specific circumstances cut off from wider society. And the way that the film, in quite a detailed and textured way, you have these early, quite quiet scenes between Thomasin McKenzie and Ben Foster of the life they lead, the routine they lead, how they survive out there in the forest, the little workarounds that they've got, the drills they go through. And I wonder why it's more successful than, in particular, Captain Fantastic, which was Aragorn from Lord of the Rings, Viggo Mortensen, with his brood of weird kids. It doesn't go in the direction that film does. It goes in quite an unpredictable direction and a more compassionate one. And there are details that crop in that I wonder come from Deborah Granik's background in independent film and documentary, these little details, and I wonder whether these little characters that pop up, whether they're non-actors. For example, the most zen, cool dude truck driver in cinema history pops up at one point, and it's a beautiful little sketch of a whole life in just one scene, this man with his dog on the great open road. It's got many little details like that. But we haven't talked about Ben Foster yet. Ben Foster, who, to make another link with Sicario too, he was in Hell or High Water that was written by Taylor Sheridan, and that was a performance that really re-announced him as an adult actor.
Yeah, he was good.
What do you think of him in this, Adam?
He's good. He's someone who I don't often enjoy that much, actually. I feel like you can always tell with him that he's really kind of committed in a way which doesn't necessarily benefit the performance or the character. I've seen him playing like Lance Armstrong, and there's a film, what's the Woody Harrelson police, Rampart, is it?
Rampart,
he plays like a Vietnam veteran, but he's in like a wheelchair in that, and he's just very, you know, he's a sort of capital A actor, I think.
He's very intense.
Very intense, and often very good, but as I say, in quite a kind of obvious, showy way.
I totally agree. And
I liked him in this.
I think he's better than I thought he would be. Mm-hmm. But I still think he's a bit, not showy, but a bit intense. Mm-hmm. But yeah, no, it's good. And he's clearly committed and he clearly cares about his part. That's good.
For me, it's such a hard character to portray because you're seeing him from the perspective of this developing child's mind, as parent as God, parent as fallible, parent as vulnerable, all these things. Mm. And he has to be all those things at once. He has to be the superhero that's living on the fringe of society, living independently. But then these doubts had to creep in about why he's there, if what he's doing is actually healthy and safe or actually putting them all in danger. It's a very hard thing to play. And I still see him as he played Angel in X-Men 3.
Of course.
The Last Stand, no one's best work.
I remember him well in that film.
Oh.
But any final comments on Leave No Trace, Adam?
There's a wonderful scene about midway through the film where they're trying to be assimilated into this, it's like a kind of halfway house, but it's like a working farm. And
it's Christmas tree
farm. It's a Christmas tree farm. And the character Tom meets a local boy and he takes her to this like rabbit grooming workshop. Mm. And there's just a really beautiful scene where these kids are being told how to correctly groom and handle an array of bunnies, and it's very sweet.
It's very sweet.
Manuela, any sweet moments?
That moment was really sweet. I think Deborah Granik is really good with animals, and it's nice. It's always good. Always
and skinning
that.
Animals usually. We'll come to that shortly.
Yeah.
Adam, what scores would you give Leave No Trace?
I think I would give this fours across the board, and really love to see more Deborah Granik work.
Mm-hmm.
I think this is only her third feature, and about 7 or 8 years between the first two, and there's been almost,
I think, 20 years almost. Three features, one documentary.
And obviously, probably mitigating circumstances and reasons for that, but we'd just love to see more from her.
Mm. Manuela?
Well, my anticipation wasn't anything substantial because I didn't know her work. But otherwise, I would say enjoyment 4 and in retrospect 4 as well. I definitely would love to see more of her work because I think she's got such a considerate and kind and smart perspective. And we need more of that. We don't want more Sicarios. We want more Leave No Trace.
Okay. And for me, 4s across the board, same as Adam. And a recommendation from me. I think this seems to have the edge over Sicario 2 this week from us. So that was Leave No Trace, directed by Deborah Granik. And now time for Film Club, which this week is Winter's Bone, also directed by Deborah Granik.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot. We charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hey, it's Danny Pellegrino from Everything Iconic. Ready to upgrade your style game without blowing your budget? Check out Quince. They've got all the good stuff, shirts and polos, activewear and fine leather goods, all at 50 to 80% less than other high-end brands. And the best part? They're all about safe, ethical and responsible manufacturing. Get that luxury vibe without the luxury price tag. Hit up Quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. That's Quince.com/upgrade.
If you're struggling to lose weight, you've probably heard about weight loss medications like Wegovy or Zepbound, and you might be wondering if they're right for you. Meet PlushCare, a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. If you qualify, they can safely prescribe you medication from the comfort of your own home. To get started, visit PlushCare.com/weightloss. That's PlushCare.com/weightloss. PlushCare.com/weightloss.
Winter's Bone, the film that announced Jennifer Lawrence onto the world stage. She stars as Ree, a teenage girl who is tasked with looking after her family while hunting down her ne'er-do-well father. Here she is, looking at one route of opportunity.
Do you mind me asking what happened to your eye and your lip?
I fell off my bike.
Fell off a bike? Well, how old are you?
17.
You're 17, okay. Now, if this is something you really wanted to do, we'd have to bring Mom and Dad in on this, okay?
I can sign for myself.
Not at 17, you can't. At 17, you're still considered a minor by the U.S. government, okay? You have to be 18 to sign up. Would it be a problem getting Mom and Dad in here? I mean, I can come out to you guys' house and...
My mom's sick. My dad's gone.
Well, do you have any brothers or sisters that might be able to help?
I got a little brother and little sister, 12 and 6.
Well, who's taking care of them right now?
I am.
You are? Is that why you need the $40,000?
Yes, sir.
Well, it sounds like it might be a bigger challenge just to stay home, you know, and actually take care of your brother and sister, because you know you're not going to be able to take them with you to training, right?
I thought maybe I could.
Not right at the beginning. Plus, you wouldn't be able to have them when you're actually in the active duty army, because who's going to be there to take care of them if you had to go off and actually fight?
Jennifer Lawrence there in her first big role. Adam, what have the listeners been saying about Winter's Bone?
People are generally pretty positive on this. So we've got David Proctor, who's tweeted in saying it's a classic, one of the best of the decade. Describes it as a backwards noir, which I quite like. Mm-hmm. Nick Imrie says he saw it in Berlin in English as a choice between that and King's Speech. Nick, you made the right choice. I thought it was excellent with a fantastic Jennifer Lawrence. Most importantly, that's when my partner discovered she was pregnant with our son. That's very nice.
Oh, that's very sweet. It's interesting there is a choice between that and King's Speech, because this Winter's Bone was nominated for so many Oscars that year. And looking back at the Oscar season that year, that was the King's Speech, Black Swan, the fighter year.
It's a big year.
Yeah. And Winter's Bone was, you know, the smallest budget and the smallest gross of the bunch.
Yeah, apparently it's the lowest grossing film nominated for Best Picture since 1983's The Dresser.
Right, I haven't
seen
that
one.
Which
I've never seen and do not know anything about.
Do not know either.
No, so there you go.
Any other tweets, Manuela?
Yeah, Chris Upton said, excellent film. The book by Daniel Woodrell is even better. I can see that.
Yeah.
And I'm going to try and pronounce this. Bjorna Fjelde said, I saw it at the Bergen International Film Festival and knew nothing about it. Jennifer Lawrence's performance blew me away. The soundtrack was original and raw.
Yeah, the soundtrack was really interesting for both these films. It's Dickon Hinchcliffe, who's one of Tindersticks, going off on his own path and very sort of acoustic and atmospheric, very appropriate for the surroundings. Manuela, we've talked about performances for all these films today, and you've been touting Jennifer Lawrence as a great performance here.
Yes.
What is it that you were responding to in Winter's Bone?
I think she's so... It's really hard to play someone who is going through a lot of emotionally draining things and not just be crying the whole time. But she manages to communicate emotion without crying the whole time. And it's like, it feels very real and it's very honest and it's not show-offy at all. It's not Ben Foster. It's like, it's very just totally committed and it's not just on the surface. She just brings so much life to everything she does. And I think that early film just showed so much promise and she delivered on that. And it's just so refreshing. Amazing.
Do you think she's lived up to that promise in the years since?
I think so. Yeah.
I mean, it depends what you're looking at. Mm-hmm. You know, for every joy, there's like a passengers. And increasingly, she's been bogged down with like the X-Men films. And it'd be interesting to see where she goes from here. Because I think she was like 19 when she made Winter's Bone. So she's still, you know, in her late 20s or something, like really young, has a lot of her career ahead of her, so it'd be interesting to see where she goes from here.
I think she's done a lot of roles that are not maybe as interesting as this one, but I think every time she really delivers, she really does her best. No one can take that away from her.
Mm-hmm. It's an incredibly mature performance, isn't it? Considering her lack of experience at the time and, you know, what she's trying to convey, this sense of, like, just this weight and this burden that this character is carrying around. And, yeah, it does feel very relatable. You can imagine that there are a lot of young women in the world, in America especially, that are carrying these burdens. I just think that's the thing that really stuck with me. Both viewings, I've seen this film twice now, and just both times you really get that sense of the maturity of her performance.
Mm. Mm-hmm. And how do you think Winter's Bone has aged? It's so interesting, as I said, about these Oscar films. They become so scrutinised for a six-month period, and then they're just put back on the shelf, and then we move on to the next year. So revisiting this 7 or 8 years afterwards, it seems so interesting compared to Leave No Trace, which is a film that just seems to just exist like real life in some on some levels, whereas Winter's Bone is definitely a mystery thriller, noirish story.
Yeah, it's definitely, it hits a few more of those sort of genre beats. And it, as I say, it's weird that Deborah Granik didn't go on from that to make a kind of bigger Oscar-y movie, really. And I think Leave No Trace is, I would say, maybe a better film, actually. But
I think so, yeah.
Feels more low-key. I don't know, I haven't read the Daniel Woodrell novel, which this is based on.
Yeah.
Winter's Bone, but yeah, possibly that's where that comes from. Maybe that is more of a kind of backwards noir thriller. But yeah, I just think it's a really impressive film.
Yeah. Any final comments, Manuela?
I enjoy Winter's Bone more because of that genre thing, I think, because it has this energy, this like shock value a bit. But it's not just shock; it feels genuine and it feels true to the context. But it goes in insane places that I did not expect, having seen Leave No Trace first. Mm-hmm. So it was very interesting for me. But I think it has this real atmospheric thing. But I don't know if atmospheric is really the right word, because when you say that, you expect something, you know, really moody. But it's not really like that. It's very much in nature and every day. And in a way, it reminded me a lot of the Darden Brothers movies.
Okay.
Because there's a lot of moments when... Not a lot, but there's, for instance, this scene you played where she talks with the army recruiter, and it's very matter of fact, and it's very like, you can't do this, you have to do that, and that doesn't feel forced. It feels just, this is how it is, and it's her trying to find help in society. It's her circumstances being confronted with insane things happening in her life, and then she has to move on. She has a family to take care of. And that realism is, I think, what makes it a weird genre film, because it's so realistic.
Yeah.
And it goes to really scary places, but it's still grounded in the daily need to, you know, provide for her family.
Yeah, that scene is so key to me, and it's what I see so much in Leave No Trace. It's this, as I said, not really finger-pointing. It's quite an apolitical film. I can imagine maybe more didactic films that would have the army recruitment officer kind of tip his hand either way.
But like the fact Ken Loach movie or something.
Well, yeah. Exactly. Something that is more directly a socio-realistic movie. I find the connection with the Dardennes quite interesting. They're the Belgian brothers who, you know, European powerhouse couple. Any particular films you'd connect it with?
Yeah, I was thinking of Rosetta.
Okay.
One of the earlier films where it's about this girl who, she lives in some really like low-income place. I can't remember exactly, but she, at some point she tries to have a job at an ice cream seller, and basically all her life is linked to this. And it's amazing because they get so much tension from that simple thing, because for her it's everything. And that really reminded me of that, like the idea of, you know, you don't have a choice. You just have to do whatever it takes to, you know, get some money, because you need money to eat and survive, because at some point that's what it comes down to. And it's sad, but that's reality. And they have this really as well, like considerate, realistic approach, you know, kind of handheld and centered on performance as well. Like the performance of the girl in Rosetta is reminding me of, Jennifer Lawrence reminded me of that one, because it's so raw and it's so just, I'm dealing with stuff now.
So Rosetta, Dardennes.
Yeah.
Another recommendation there, maybe a future film club pick.
Oh, yeah, definitely.
And so I think that was Winter's Bone. What should we look forward to next week, Adam?
Well, it seems to be picking up again, the old cinema fixtures. So we've got quite a lot out next week, but we've picked out Whitney, which is the Kevin MacDonald documentary.
The second one this year.
The second one of the year, and supposedly the better one as well.
Uh-huh.
Then a strange-looking film called Ideal Home, which is Steve Coogan and Paul Rudd. It looks a bit like The Birdcage. Sort of vibes, but we'll see. And then Michael Cimino's The Deer Hunter, which is being re-released next week. 4K restoration.
Fantastic.
Bit of a classic. I feel like we haven't done one of those for a while.
A new Hollywood classic, exactly. I think they're quite a bucket list film for many people, including me.
Right.
Mm-hmm. So if you want to get watching The Deer Hunter and send us your comments, we're on Twitter @LWLies. There's the email address, truthandmovies@tcolondon.com. And of course, there is also ldvlives.com/podcast, the comments field on there. I suppose that just leaves me to say thank you, Adam, for joining me today.
Thank you.
And thank you, Manuela.
Thank you for having me.
And thank you for listening. I've been Michael Leader, and as always, this has been a 7 Digital production.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And is all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here, and it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.